Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hi, friends. I'm back.
And Brian Brushwood.
Yeah, you wish I was back, but I'm front. No, I got nothing. I got nothing. Hello. Right. Hi, I'm Brian.
Just got to commit, man. Just got to commit. gentlemen, how long are we doing this podcast?
Man, long enough to know better. 7 years now? Eight?
Jeez, is that? Yeah, it would...
Yeah, 2010. Early days. It was shortly before. I think you guys started it in 2009, and I joined after the first episode.
Yeah.
This is weird enough. You know, one of the ways we could keep doing this forever by living forever.
Oh, that's a good idea. Now, hold on. When you say live forever, do we need our corporeal forms to live forever, or could, you know, a simulacrum of our personalities live on forever? Which is the more durable way to live forever?
I mean, obviously, the more durable will be some sort of like cloud type, you know, personality upload eventually. But we want to wait for the tech to get there. And I have a funny story I've never mentioned on these microphones, which I'll bring up about that. But amusing story. I thought it was. But anyhow. You know, I think for a while we want to keep this, you know, the meat puppets, you know, working for a while until we work up the upgrade. And, you know, the good thing about this sort of the instead of the Silicon Age, the Gilded Age, the Gilded Age of Silicon that we live in now, with a lot of aging billionaires who made their money in their 30s and their 40s, is now they spend their money to pursuits that are important to them. And one of them is life extension.
Man. Is it? Can we? I'm sure we've talked about this before. We've talked about Silicon Valley vampires sucking up young people's bloods.
Talk a bit about that, Bryce. Huh? Talk about your role with Bryce.
No, I'm just saying. That's one of the kooky things I hear about is rich billionaires just getting young people's
rich
bloods.
Billionaires, Brian, with a lot
As
of money.
To those middle class billionaires,
rich billionaires with a lot of money.
I gotta be like middle class billionaires is like the next political campaign gaffe, like that is gonna get hung around some politician's neck.
But you know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, these wealthy rich billionaires with a lot of money.
Yes, yes, and then they also, but that's not enough. They also want the blood of young people because it's magic, and so they put young people's blood in their bodies, and then they insist that it's not the placebo effect and that they're actually living healthier now.
And there's evidence to that. There's evidence that the having blood and some of the evidence implies that it's not so much the idea that young blood, it's just not having all that old blood in you.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, which, you know, maybe people say that's splitting hairs, but the idea that is that you get older, that your blood might be less responsive to repairing things, et cetera, and all that. And if you get younger blood in you, that can make a difference, which also implies that there might be forms of just blood therapy, whatever, that could improve that. So, you know, have been, you know, interesting bits of research into that, which, you know, it creeps people out because that just reeks of vampires and all sorts of spooky stuff. But okay.
But then there's, man, it's weird to think of your body as a symphony of all these independent systems running in parallel, because we hear that a lot of your health and even aspects of your personality is affected by your gut bacteria. Don't you have like, what, I want to say 30 pounds of gut bacteria? That may be insane talk.
Not that much, but still a lot. Like you got like more DNA in your body belongs to gut bacteria than to you.
Yeah. And then they do gut bacteria transfusions where it's like, we could change your body type by, you know, pumping in other people's blood, other people's gut bacteria.
There's
we
other kinds
change
of
your body type.
There's other stuff they can move from one organ to another.
Yeah. Yes. Lots of stuff.
It's just one of these things. Get an actor. We need to do a what? Are you a real doctor?
Well, the first time I heard about it, I think it was on a Freakonomics episode. And then and I'm like, no, they're not serious, are you? And then an hour later, you're like, this is a revolutionary field. This is going to be amazing.
So that's just, you know, it's an expanding area. There are a lot of companies now dedicated towards life expansion. They're, you know, and the there are, you know, bioethicists and stuff. Should we be focusing on extending life? Yes. Yes. Population, overpopulation is not the problem people think it is. And the worst problem is going to be a decrepit population. People living on, you know, statins and things like that to stay longer, but not healthy enough to go do anything. So let's not worry about, you know, a bunch of people who have, you know, have owned houses, have worked their lives, have raised families, have acquired a lot of knowledge. I think keeping them around is a good idea. Call me crazy. Call me crazy.
Yeah. When did we first, as a society, begin worrying about overpopulation? Like, what is the first recorded time where, like, overpopulation became, like, a scare?
You had, you know, the point at which it became this popular sort of topic was Robert Malthus. And so around the late 1700s, early 1800s, in some of his writings he wrote on population, that was one of the first points at which it became this, ooh, maybe we need to worry about this.
And then in the 20th century, it saw a big, big boost with Paul Ehrlich's book, The Population Bomb, and where he, you know, with a straight face,
Club made of Rome.
Claims of mass famines and millions, or if not billions, of people starving to death in the mid 80s. And then the big surprise, of course, was the Green Revolution and the work of Norman Borlaug, when all of a sudden, you know, we went from, you know, 7 bushels per hectare or whatever to 70. And
you've had even, you know, prior to the Haber-Bosch process, which was the ability to create, you know, nitrogen-based fertilizers. And because that was you get these periods where people are like, oh, my gosh, what are we going to do? Like, one of the problems you had was Malthus's time was that, you know, the amount of human labor, the amount of land, available land. And then he, you know, he said that, which is true. It's like, hey, if people reproduce faster than farmland, then at some point people will outrun farmland, which is, yeah, doy. But, and that was his, the basis sort of his argument was that these things, but we found out that people don't reproduce as fast as he thought. And actually our farm yields were increasing. In the United States, we reached what was called peak farmland, like a decade or so, which means that we use less land to feed us than we did before, even though our population's increasing. And you had a problem when we started the age of, you know, Industrial Revolution created benefits because, wow, we can increase the amount of yield. We can plant these, you know, farms faster. We can, you know, sow, et cetera, all these things. That created a big boon as far as agriculture. But then slowly as mechanization increased, we started switching to combustion engines and using less animals. It decreased the amount of fertilizer. And then when we were going through the bat guano shortages, that's when the Haber-Bosch process came along, which was, hey, you know, we can actually create nitrogen-based fertilizers, and that just dramatically increased, you know, food production. And then, as Brian pointed out, Norman Borlaug came up with, you know, strains of wheat that just dramatically increased food yield, et cetera. And, you know, he's, you know, one of the biggest heroes of the 20th century, you know, if you ask the right people. But, yeah, it goes through these cycles. I just went to a conference on this like a couple weeks ago too. So I was like, that was our whole reading list was like, and there was a really great critique of Malthus by Frederick Engels of all people. And so,
oh, really?
You're around a bunch of, you know, of market liberals reading Engels going, you know, he makes some good points here. Anyhow,
Engels, the Pete Best of the communist revolution.
Yeah. You have at this point, we have a lot of research for this, and one of the things that's interesting, they just discovered an anti-aging gene in an Amish population.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, they found this group of people. They found this particular gene that seems to be, you know, tied into longevity, et cetera. And it makes for kind of like, you know, weird sci-fi stories that weird reclusive people, there's something special about them. And now there's a search for more of these.
But. So, and I guess... I mean, we're so early on the research and all this stuff. And plus also, I don't know how much of the research will, I guess I shouldn't be in the business of making negative predictions, but let's say we did figure out what the gene is. It's not like we have a gene therapy that you just take a shot and suddenly have that, right?
Well, we do. And we actually have, that's another topic we get into is, you have CRISPR, which is the, we isolated which gene we think this is. And there's CRISPR, there's CRISPR and Cas9 are two different techniques that let you actually insert genes directly into DNA at specific points. And there are now people who are like experimenting on their own with this stuff, doing their own like gene therapy.
So this is, I mean, I guess like when the price of doing this comes down enough and the possibility of it succeeding yields such a tremendous reward, I mean, hell, like why not have your Hialeah inside the garage liposuction if it meant gene therapy that could make you live for another 40 years, right? People already do it for cosmetic reasons. This is literally life extension.
So here's a headline from the Mirror. Rogue scientist attempts to make himself superhuman by editing his own DNA to get boosted strength and muscle growth. Hosai Zainer, a biochemist and former NASA worker, has become the first person known to have edited his DNA after removing a protein which inhibits muscle growth. And this is from 2 days ago. He used the CRISPR tool. He writes, he said, quote, "This is the first time in history that we are no longer slaves to our genetics." It's such technology.
That's a bit of an incendiary.
Okay, but not illegal to edit your own DNA.
Yep. Stay off my property, government. I'm editing my DNA.
Now, do we know how successful he is? Like, does the new DNA propagate through your whole body? Or are you briefly a chimera with two different sets of DNA?
He initially expected to see extra muscle growth in that one arm that he injected. Another U.S. biohacker plans to insert a genetic mutation that lets humans see the ultraviolet spectrum.
Okay, that doesn't seem like that would work because it's a bit like trying to learn language past the critical period. I would think, like let's say you suddenly had the ability to see ultraviolet. I don't know that the brain would know how to handle that data or show it. Like, because like my wife is legally blind of one eye, and even if that eye just magically fixed itself today, it wouldn't. Her brain wouldn't know how to process any of that.
I mean, if it got the extra input, would it maybe over time evolve? Because we know that like people who have been deaf since birth, when they do cochlear implants.
That's true. That's true. And it's not as bad as because we used to think that the brain was just super rigid past, you know, the age of 15 or so. But neuroplasticity indicates that that we were wrong about that. But
yeah,
I don't know.
So this guy's basically going to turn himself into Morty from, you know, an episode of Rick and Morty. The one arm is mutated.
One gigantic, super big, murderous arm.
Yeah. I think this is dangerous. I think this is fraught with peril. I think this is maybe borderline stupid, and I wholly encourage it. Listen, that was like there was a lot of controversy over the herpes virus study that was being done in I forget which country, where there were some researchers that were thought the process was very long. So they went and they did it over there. Then they had some promising results. Then Peter Thiel came in and funded it. And then it got conflated into Peter Thiel funds this overseas study and da 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 da. It's like, you know, the people screaming the loudest had the least amount of information to go on that. And it was people were completely knew what they're being tested. The researcher who did the research had tested on himself and whatnot. But, you know, you get in this era of like, we have a lot of exciting, promising things happening. And, you know, sometimes maybe the existing processes by which we say yes or no to testing this thing or the hurdles you have to go through, there's an argument to be made that they're quite onerous. And that if you're a small team that has a pretty effective technique that you want to test, the cost doing that, you know, we have to listen to politicians yell about, you know, oh, the pharmaceutical industry. What does it cost to bring one drug to market? What is the cost for just trying to bring one drug versus including all the other stuff they test and does not work, you know, and not a lot of talk about is it really expensive to do that?
Well, you know, I mean, it certainly is very expensive. And it's one of the I've always been fascinated by the industries that, and not to say that it's wrong that they are forced to do this, but are kind of forced to play defense against themselves. Like the fact that, you know, the cigarette industry funds their own opposition, you know, PSAs and all the medicine companies that are, you know, the drug companies that have to film all the like softly lit B-roll of the woman like rolling out pizza dough while they talk about how your stomach's going to, you know, inflate to the point where you float away and you're going to have, you know, all sorts of horrifying side effects because legally they have to mention that they happened during the trial for the drug.
Atmospheric phlotitis. Oh, oof.
Yeah.
There's a, now there's the attorneys, you know, who are, you know, just asking for family members to, you know, file lawsuits.
Yeah. If you or that, someone you know has had their stomach inflate to the point where they comically lifted above the skyline, please.
This is not Harry Potter, folks. This is serious. Yeah. It's a, you know, it is a very, it gets into an area that people get uncomfortable with. But I mean, I would argue that probably, you know, you have a greater, you have a greater chance of getting sick from a farmer's market than you do from, you know, a number of these trials. And some of these trials they do, like, there's, you know, dangerous things and things have happened. They've done gene replacement, you know, there was a gene replacement study that, you know, killed people and it was just done sloppy. It was poorly done, but it was a regulated trial. And, you know, not, and that's, people have that, that the precautionary principle is one of the most dangerous things ever, is that we overestimate the danger from one thing and vastly underestimate the benefit from something else. So.
Yeah. I wonder, you know, even if, like, it seems, I don't know, wholly irresponsible to, you know, modify your own genes. But it also seems like now is the best time in all of human history, because if you do something wrong, they'll hopefully be learning a lot from your mistakes so that in the next 20 years, they can fix it. If like theoretically, whatever you mess up, I assume it's possible to fix back.
One would hope, you know, if you're around and alive.
And if not, you're going to die trying.
At that conference I went to, the population conference, is interesting is that I talked to two people there who had the I think they were the Alcor medallions, which is the, you know, if you die, put me on ice, call this number and we'll come pick up your body and put you into, you know, frozen storage and then revive you at a later date. And the two people I talked to, having to hear me talk about space stuff and science stuff, were surprised that I didn't have one. Like, what? You don't have this? What? You don't have this? And I'm like, I think the singularity is more likely. So I'm sure there's a backup somewhere.
Yeah, I got, well, and the big problem with that is, of course, when you freeze the body, ice crystals, ice expands, all the water in your body, they become little daggers, and your whole body upon being frozen gets freezer burned, basically, which means your brain just gets cut to ribbons and you become this porridge sludge. But the counter argument is, well, yes, we can't imagine how to put those pieces back together today, but in 1,000 years, they'll just run a scanner and it'll be the best copy of my body that exists.
Well, Brian, I want you to refer to the Alcor.org page. Myth number two, cryonics freezes people.
Oh really?
Which, to be fair, I said they freeze people, but well, Brian, the current technology favored by Alcor is vitrification, not freezing. Vitrification is an ice-free process in which more than 60% of the water inside the cells is replaced with protective chemicals. Just wrap your cells in a warm hug. This completely prevents freezing during deep cooling. Instead of freezing, molecules just move slower and slower until all chemistry stops at the glass transition temperature, approximately minus 184 degrees centigrade. Unlike freezing, Brian, there is no ice formation or ice damage in vitrified tissue. Blood vessels have been reversibly vitrified, and a whole kidney has been recovered and successfully transplanted with long-term survival after vitrification temperatures of minus 135 degrees.
I like the whole do you want to build a straw man thing where you set me up and then turn me around.
No, I had no idea. I had heard that there was like new processes they used that didn't freeze.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, I wonder what I read what Alcor says. You know, I'm like, because I'm sure they got to hear this all the time.
Sure, then, sure.
No, I was not. I believed as you did. And as I said the words, I'm like, you know,
maybe I should check that.
Yeah.
That's cool. I had heard that they were, I guess that must be the same process, but the way I'd heard it was like basically antifreeze so that everything doesn't quite freeze.
Myth number three, cryonics preserves dead people. The purpose of cryonics is to save the lives of living people, not inter the bodies of the dead. Death is a neurological process that begins after the heart stops. A stopped heart only causes death if nothing is done when the heart stops. That's emphasis theirs. Cryonics proposes to do something. In the words of a mainstream critical care expert writing for the American College of Surgeons, in this area of critical care, death is more a process than an event. A prognosis of death cannot serve as a diagnosis. So their argument is like, no, like we're preserving you. Like you may be partly dead.
Wow.
But if you come to us, we will stave off the wolves until we can rescue you.
Man, death.
Hit pause.
Death,
save point.
Death as a process, not an event, is I mean, that's totally accurate, right? Because, you know, when does death count? You know, with clearly you can have conscious thought after your heart stops beating for some amount of time.
Right. So what is the deal with this company? Like, do you pay them monthly, like just so they can spring into action? Or is that a one-time thing? Or what's the deal?
I wonder if you can make them a beneficiary of your insurance or something.
We got minimum cryopreservation funding amount, $200,000 whole body cryopreservation.
So you just pay into the trust, and then the trust makes money as an investment portfolio.
And I think their myth page hinted that insurances can sometimes pay for this.
While other people may buy into the death myth. I think I've heard that too. That like you can use your insurance policy to cover it.
Although, if you think about it, though, you can't use your life insurance policy to do it because if
you're not dead,
exactly.
Well, but again, if the insurance company says you're dead,
that's how interesting. The first time they turned the light back on for somebody, insurance company is going to be like, whoa, consumer fraud division, activate.
Exactly, we're going to need all that money back. Well, I'll tell you what, you guys can make sure that we are not only doing this show each and every week, but also each and every week forever, even if one of us dies.
Well, and again, not technically dead. Death is a process, not an event. Dead.
Oh, we'll just funding methods. Number one, life insurance.
Wow.
And they list life insurance agents that will sell you the policy.
That's amazing.
Well, I'll tell you what, you guys can help make sure that happens by going to patreon.com/weirdthings. That's where you go ahead and kick in some cash. We do the show each and every week. We have a great time. And also, you get your own little RSS feed. Man, if you've never become a patron on patreon.com, you got to go ahead and do it just for the special RSS feeds. They make sure that no matter what level that you're at, you get the exact all the benefits that you pay for. I know personally, I've not kicked up my, you know, extra money to different companies because I've always been afraid when they're like, oh, get bonus podcasts. I'm like, I have no idea where I'm going to get these things from, or I'll have to listen to them through a browser. Easy peasy lemon squeezy. When you go to patreon.com/weirdthings, get a special RSS feed, enter it right into the podcatcher of your choice. It could not be easier. You go ahead and get not only this show, but also After Things before anybody else. It is a great time. Go ahead and do it. patreon.com/weirdthings.
Gentlemen, little side note you might find interesting. Last night I was at a friend's birthday party and I got to talk to Dr. Phil Lubin. Phil Lubin, who we've mentioned before, is the scientist who kind of really advanced the state of laser propulsion, you know, did some great papers talking about how we have the technology now using things like phased arrays, which is a bunch of emitters acting in concert, which can create a beam that goes much further out. And that was the Project Starshot, the whole, hey, let's send a probe to the next star system. That was based on Phil's work. And then kind of, I would argue, took credit for Phil's work, even though citing Phil's work is why that exists. But anyhow, one of the other interesting applications he talked about is if you have a large laser array on the Earth, what they could do is you could use it to lift satellites and things like the International Space Station to higher orbits. Not with a, you know, by just a steady beam of light hitting it and the photons bouncing off of it, not to any degree. Like there's certain materials you can cover it that's not going to fry the occupants on board. The energy levels are low or whatever. And it was just very interesting, you know, hearing like the different sort of applications and stuff for that. And I think we need to build a big ass laser. I think we need the big ass laser initiative.
You want to weaponize planet Earth and have it ready to go?
That's one option. One way to frame it, Brian.
Well, I mean, you got a lot of people out here that got a lot of money that have a lot of forward thinking. Like, you know, Elon is obviously like very scared or rightfully ringing the alarm bells about AI and stuff like that. You got to figure at some point someone's got enough money and enough land out in the middle of America that they're going to build some gigantic super space laser, JIC.
Sure. Hey, speaking of being scared of AIs, they beat us at chess and we said nothing because, I didn't play chess.
Chess is for nerds.
they beat us at Go and I remained silent. But now, coming for our parkour. Do you see the latest Boston Dynamics robot? Parkour, backflipping, jumping around robot?
CG, Brian, it's not real.
I wish.
That's not real, Brian.
That is, here, we're looking at it right here.
It's not real.
The video is titled, What's New Atlas? And he's jumping on boxes and jumping from box to box. And you see the stabilization in the knees as he's wobbling, as he jumps, does a 360. And then jumps like Michael Scott on The Office.
It's not real, Brian. It's not real.
Get ready for the backflip. The backflip of a humanoid robot.
It's not real, Brian. It's not real. I don't live in this universe.
And then the triumphant arms raised. It makes me sad. Leave us parkour.
I remember going to Disneyland and watching the Asimo demonstration, the robot. Remember Asimo, the robot?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
And not the most high-tech thing compared to what we have today. But they have this moment where runs across the stage. I saw this with a friend, Mary Juris, right? We watch him, like, he goes, he's going to run across the stage. He goes, he does this, like, scurry across the stage. And people are like, delight. Mary and I just stare at each other just in horror because it was so lifelike, and it's like they made it small so it doesn't scare you. But that's part of it, is they make these things a little smaller. So maybe like a person can pick it up, but you make it bigger and it's terrifying. It is terrifying. I saw this. I'm like, oh, that's the creepiest thing I've ever seen.
I mean, that's a killing machine, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That back flipping. We're all like, look at him. He can do a back. Look, put him in the Robo Olympics. He's such a cute little bugger. That's a killing machine.
With a 9mm gun attached to it. To be fair. Yeah. It's that psychologically, it's that uncanny valley of just watching this thing or this the other side watching this very human like thing that's like, there's no soul there.
Yeah. It reminds me of I got a tweet earlier today. I'm gonna see if I can find it, but somebody sent to me. It was part of some kind of spam campaign. If you type in lethal autonomous weapons, it's this little 8-minute short movie of taking place in the very near future, where basically a cloud, like just pointing out the incredible lethality of drone clouds. If you have a swarm, you can have one big drone. Attach to the side of a wall, explode, creating a hole, and then the 20 small ones come up, each one with basically a single bullet, basically getting right up to the forehead of a human, and then pop, and then just make brains go squishy. Like, that's terrifying.
Yeah, future's scary. I'm gonna go talk to these Amish people
who live forever with their awesome genetics.
I mean, is this what the dawn of like firearms? We're just like, all right, we're used to kind of fighting with these certain tools, and now all of a sudden,
just the rules are all different.
Yeah, there's just this like quantum leap in violence.
I'll tell you what, on his podcast, Hardcore History, Dan Carlin talks about the invasion of Genghis Khan and all of his hordes, and he couches it as the possessors of the most advanced military technology on the planet. Nobody was able to do mounted archery until Genghis Khan's folks. And then as a result, nobody had any way to handle that. And they just got steamrolled right over it. So I could totally see the next something like this. Oof. Can you imagine the terror of just looking up and seeing a cloud of those things coming and knowing that you're just radiating your heat signature and this AI little flying bug has one bullet with your brain on it.
Blarp. is what my comment is officially.
Is that the sound of you pooping your pants?
LARP, I don't know. That's horrifying. Look at it. Just pouring out. What is this for?
I don't.
This is just some video that the Future of Life Institute created.
Yeah.
He's a UC Berkeley professor. Stuart Russell is the host of this video. I don't know. But
so this is real or?
No, this is all fiction, but there's no reason that I think they were just basically doing a awareness campaign. Like basically several people I've heard who are in the security business say that the public at large does not appreciate what an existential threat drone technology is going to be, because it's going to be so cheap and so available. You know, once you start strapping bombs to it, you know, you spend $500 on, you know, a decent drone, just program it to swoop in the middle of a, you know, you could like think about somebody giving a giant speech inside a Super Bowl Superdome or whatever. And the thing just flies right up and explodes on stage.
So they're one of the groups that's, you know, talked about, you know, the risk that, you know, that we face if we don't kind of keep an eye on AI. And they're not anti-AI, but one of these. And I like scientific advisory board, Nick Bostrom. All right, cool. George Church, great. Christoph Koch, listen to him talk. Elon Musk, great. Martin Rees, great. Alan Alda, Morgan Freeman.
Hey, listen, man, somebody's got to be there for the parties.
Yeah. I mean, and also Alan Alda, you know, he's a fan of science. He hosted the Scientific American TV show, right?
Yeah, I just love it. You know, listen, who's there to I'm here to talk to the AI and to talk them down.
Yeah.
Do you like the sweater? I got this in Connecticut. It's very nice. So speaking of very frightening automated things, did any of you watch the Tesla announcement?
I didn't. I just listened to the side chatter. Can you talk me through the highlights of that?
So, Justin, you watch it?
Just the highlights online.
So it's worth watching the whole thing if you get the chance. So Tesla was going to predictably unveil their semi. They want to have a semi truck, which they hope will, you know, help limit the use of CO2 fuels. I mean, you know, carbon, you know, CO2 using fuels, et cetera, for transportation. Part of their plan is not just to be like, oh, well, you know, how are you powering it? Well, they want to use solar power to, you know, provide the energy for it. That's the goal. So anyhow, they have these semis that look to be, because they're electric, look like they haul ass. It's a technical term from that. They did a big unveil. They showed that. They showed all the different features of this, the power, et cetera, and that they're going to reduce the cost of, you know, per mile cost by like 30% or something to that effect. They explained that if you're using these in a convoy, if you have a number of, we just talked to this on the last podcast, actually, about the idea that Tesla might be talking about using a bunch of these semis in a row and drafting off of each other. Tesla said that, Elon Musk rather said that, hey, this will actually be cheaper than rail, which is, you know, a big phenomenal kind of thing. So kind of really amazing. He did a really cool intro. They did it over at that airport is the airport right next to SpaceX, by the way.
Oh, right on.
So they did the unveil there. They showed the different models they had of the Tesla semi. They're taking pre-orders now. We predicted on this podcast that probably one of the first people to buy some of them would be Walmart, and that's what happened. A number of other companies that have to have their own fleets have gotten made reservations on it. We don't know how many have been made yet. He showed how fast the thing accelerates. It goes 0 to 60 in 5 seconds. This is a semi. It gets fully loaded with, you know, 80,000 pounds of cargo. It has something like a 500-mile round-trip range, which is incredible. That's twice what sites were saying The Verge. I'm like, well, the problem is it's going to only have like a 240-mile range. No, it had double the range some people were predicting. So, you know, going up an incline, you know, 5-degree incline can go 65 miles an hour. An amazing, amazing beast if they're able to deliver. You know, that's obviously with Tesla, that's the big question. Can they deliver it? And then he had, hey, one more thing. Like they said, oh, he's like, thank you very much. The lights went out. It's like a concert, you know, and it's like, oh, I guess Van Halen's ready to leave the stage, you know. But then he goes out and he starts shaking hands with people and Elon Musk is still lurking around. You're like, wait a second. Then one of the semis moves towards the center and then it's totally dark. And then all of a sudden we see two headlights and then something rolls out of the back of the semi.
And so what is this, a new roadster?
Roadster 2, Ryan.
Yeah.
Roadster 2. 0 to 60 in 1.9 seconds.
Wow. Wow. Okay.
Top speed, and that's the spec. That's where Elon Musk is right now. He says the actual speed will be faster. Top speed, 250 miles an hour plus, and ready for the range, 620 miles of range.
Wow. Wow. How long? I wonder how long it takes to recharge that semi.
30 minutes to get 400 miles of range.
What? That's extraordinary. And that really could be like if
I'll take you down for a semi and a roadster, taking your order now.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Well, put that on my bucket list. Just got to make a few scam stuff. Having a big sale this weekend.
So here's the brilliance of Elon Musk and why he irritates some people and others go, yes, this is brilliant. So they unveiled the new Roadster 2 and said, hey, this thing's going to ship in like 2020. And it's going to be the Founder Series. They're going to do a limited edition, 1,000 of the Founder Series, $250,000. You have to pay the $250,000 now.
You just write that check, and sometime down the road, you get this amazing beast.
Yeah, and Tesla gets $250 million interest-free loan.
Just boom. Wow.
And if you want to get just the regular Roadster 2, there's upgrade packages, things like that. That's just a $50,000 deposit.
Wow. How much is the Roadster 2 going to be, not Founders Edition?
$200,000, Brian.
Oh, well, that seems reasonable.
Yeah. There's watching the video right now. Look at the video. If you want to turn on the volume on, actually start it from before and like listen to the VOD on that. That is amazing.
Head up against head restraint.
Three, yes, sir.
Two, one.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
Like that. That was 80.
That was like a roller coaster. Oh, my God. The G-forces. That is incredible. Oh, wow.
Night long, just crazy.
Oh my God!
All night long.
I would imagine
that is intense.
It doesn't help much
and
seeing
the carbon ceramic
the video to make it sound any less sexual. Like it really sounds like somebody just had a moment.
Yes.
This just in: new update from Brian Brushwood. Free ride in a Tesla Roadster 2 to the first 1,333 people who buy the Outlaw Vault.
Oh. Yeah, there you
go. Expected ship date 2020.
Smart. I like it.
Man, you know, obviously this made a big, big splash, including Elon never shy of setting the bar where it is. He then went to Twitter and in typical Elon Musk fashion, then also teased, hey, you know, it's amazing what you can do when you apply the rocket technology that we're working on with SpaceX to some of these vehicles.
No. Is it for reals?
For real.
Not saying the next generation Roadster's special upgrade package will definitely be able to fly short hops, but maybe. That's amazing. Just a question of safety rocket tech applied to a car.
So that's the world we live in. The thing I was thinking about was you're talking about a production car that can go 250 miles an hour or more. And one of the things that we talked about before is Elon Musk with the Boring Company, by which I'm wearing a hat right now. You know, they talk about the idea of like having these tunnels and putting cars onto these skates, these electric skates, which would go ridiculously fast, a couple hundred miles an hour through a tunnel to get, you know, the throughput really high. I think it's time to start thinking about the idea of as you get more electric cars on the road that can go stupid fast, the idea of not just a special lane for electric cars or robot cars for automatic cars that are under fully automatic control, but the idea of saying, oh, yeah, we'll make the speed limit, you know, 150 miles an hour.
I mean,
well, you would hope so, right? Like you would hope that once you can have some assurances that these things are going to just be running programmatically, that you would be able to turn the heat up a little bit, right?
Yeah. The man, it's going to be an interesting 10 years, I guess. What kind of penetration do you think we'll see in 10 years of these? Because I'm already, like, in one day in Austin, and obviously there's a selection bias with Austin being a fairly hip Silicon, they call it the Silicon Hills. I saw six Teslas in one day just driving around. And I saw a Model X and five Model S's. And I wonder how much farther, where that, if not Teslas, then, you know, similar style cars.
Well,
I mean, I think we're probably in the three most like least representative cities for that question.
Right? Austin, like, Oakland, and LA. Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of Tesla. I mean, like, listen, I was one of those things that I noticed when I first moved to Oakland was that, like, I was parallel parking, like, you know, bumping my, like, 2007 Toyota Matrix bumper into, you know, Tesla Roadsters that are just randomly parked on the street. So,
well, that's, you know, where something like there's like a couple hundred thousand Teslas out there now, right? And, you know, in LA, like, yeah, I see, you know, I half a dozen an hour, you know, they're everywhere. You know, I walk out in my parking lot in front of me in the supermarket, I'll see some Teslas there. That being said, once the Model 3 production ramps up, you know, either, you know, first half of next year or the second half of next year, it's people are like focusing too much on the 6 month time frame and not the 2 year and 3 year time frame. You know, when they get up to their goal is to get up to something like a half a million a year in production.
Wow.
And the total, you know, that's when, and that's, you're going to see these things everywhere. And then as you get other car companies start increasing production, as the demand increases, you know, GM has announced an entire fleet of electric cars they want to make. I will take GM seriously when they start building battery plants and when they start building their own charging networks, you know, and they could do two of those things by making strategic investments. But when they start saying that was a problem with, like, the Bolt was like, yeah, Bolt seems like by all accounts like a really solid car. And GM's like, no, it's not a compliance car is a term they used because under regulations right now, car manufacturers have to produce a certain number of electric vehicles, you know, to meet certain, you know, the government demands. And those are called the compliance vehicles. So they'll do a limited number to meet that. And so GM's like, no, the Bolt's not a compliance car. We want this thing to sell huge numbers. Well, the problem is that, like, they produce such limited numbers of electric cars that the incentives for electric car manufacturing works way more to their advantage than Tesla, because Tesla's like, even if we keep the same, you know, laws that got, you know, the incentives that government, you know, right now, you know, the Congress is threatening to get rid of, Tesla's like, yeah, well, once you get start doing 500,000 cars a year, you're not, there's no, those incentives don't help you because you run out of this, there's no more incentive money there, etc. So, point being, once companies like GM and stuff say, oh no, let's really make a car that makes a profit on their own, like Tesla's trying to do, and once they start putting together an infrastructure, that's going to be big. That'll be really, really big. You know, it's, you know, I think we're going to see a heck of a lot of Teslas on the road, but I think when we really want to see the full electrification of cars and automation, it's not just going to be Tesla.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely think that's the case. So as far as like 10 years from now, what percentage of cars on the road are fully electric, do you think?
All right. Well, let me ask you a question though. Okay. Because as we're moving more towards, like, Uber just signed a deal with Volvo to buy something like 42,000 of their automated electric cars, right?
Yeah.
So you're going to say, like, what percentage, and I guess, you know, you asked it in a fair way, we're going to figure out how do we answer it, the cars on the road. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, when I go stand, you know, 8 p.m. out on Burbank, the number of Uber cars that drive by is pretty high. And you go downtown L.A., really, really high. Now, the number of cars in L.A., you know, that aren't Uber, 99%, you know, but you would think half of all cars were Uber. So I think that in certain areas, certain times of day, I'm going to say the majority of cars in 10 years are going to be electric.
Wow.
In high density urban areas.
As far as like just sitting on a street corner, counting them as they go by.
Yeah.
I could see that. I think that's a really good point, too, when you think about which ones are being used, especially if 10 years from now, one of the ideas we talked on this show a while ago was the idea that you take your car to work and then you enter it into Uber mode and you just let it drive around on its own, picking up fares and taking them places and then dropping them off.
Well, and you think of, like, if you go to electric and they have a pretty good, you know, one of the things that Tesla sold with the Semi was, hey, we'll guarantee you like 7 cents a kilowatt, whatever, 7 cents So you, if you're a trucking company, you can predict, you can have a spreadsheet that will tell you exactly what you're going to save right now by doing that. If you start moving one to electrification, you know, you're probably going to see in certain, depends on what regions you're in, but you could see a 20-30% reduction in your cost per mile or more. I'm just pulling that figure out of nowhere, but mm-hmm. you could see an automatic cost and reduction in mileage for those cars, which means that your Uber and using fleet, you know, the ride sharing drops tremendously. Once we get to automation, which I do think within 10 years, yes, we will see this in certain areas and stuff. Your cost per mile drop dramatically. And it's that, you know, I'm at the point now where sometimes I'm like, I'll go take an Uber downtown Burbank because I don't want to worry about parking. And it's there'll be parking there, but I don't want to drive around a parking garage for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And so I think that increases as those costs fall. It's just, you know, the fewer cars we have that are capable of doing that get used much more, as you're pointing out.
Justin, now that you've gotten rid of your car and embraced the Uberfication of your transportation, how's it been now that you've had a week or two to live with it?
I've actually been doing it for the past couple months just to see whether or not, like, what the money difference was and what, you know, it was like to try to use my car as little as possible. And so it's really not that much of a change from how it has been. But ultimately, really, the big news is that there's really no news. Like, it's just really easy and really cheap to get around in ride sharing through any of the various different means or public transportation. It's a lot. The thing that I've noticed the most is having the phantom limb. Ah, crap. Do I got to move my car? Oh, wait, I don't have a car anymore. Okay.
That's awesome.
Good mood for you.
Yeah.
Do we want to jump into picks or do we have time for Journey Quest? What's our schedule like here?
I think we have time. We were on a bit of a cliffhanger. We were about to see someone's face.
I know.
I feel like let's jump in. Let's jump in. Let's do some Journey Quest.
All right.
Unless this is the DM's out because he forgot to write.
Oh no. Okay. Oh no. It's shut your mouth.
Right. Let's go. Let's go then. Let's go ahead and get into Journey Quest.
Previously on
Journey Quest. Master plan came to full fruition, huh? You have me shoot off your ding dong so you can get a 2-foot.
But there's only one catch. You have to kill my champion. And he raises his visor.
Mind controlled Justin Robert Young.
I just cut out his vocal cords. Yeah, so I guess I murdered the fake Justin because I wanted to simplify things. And it seems like trapped under the mind control serum is actual Justin. How many combatants was I up against?
So the curtain rolled up. You saw mind controlled Justin. Right. You're supposed to fight. Then the Golden Emperor's like,
oh, wait for the surprise. Wait for the twist.
giggling. Curtain raises. And you see some more, you know, Gene Simmons edition boots there. Right.
Yeah.
Raising. You're like, look a little like Bryce boots. I'm just saying. But you're like, what's going on here? A little bit more, and then you see they're like made of like metal studs, right? And they've got big, big brassy buckles, a little bit higher, knee pads with spikes coming out. Like, that can't be really comfortable to put on, right? Then, like, you know, the quads, like, I mean, these thighs are like really, really muscular, right? And then I'm gonna say the cod piece is a little bit comedically large, you know, like a little bit, you know, not just airy, it's bulbous, and it's really kind of like, okay. Then you get up to like.
I love the fact that right when you got to the cod piece, as if rolling his eyes, Bryce types in the chat. Well, again, it's me. I'm sure.
Well, no, I'm asking. Andrew describes so many characters that I think, is this me? If you put me in this again.
So now we get to this big belt buckle, right? And there's a logo on there, and I don't want to. It's hard for you to understand. You can't quite see it from here, right? So I won't even get into it, but it's sort of the stylized diamond. It's a little blinding. You try to look at the logo. Then you see like a six-pack, like a super muscular six-pack, right? And you're like, because that latex, is that really, really a latex? And a half shirt, kind of like, you know, a guy, you know, junior high school football player kind of guy would work back in the 1980s sort of thing, you know.
Jesus Christ, Chuck Tingle, get to the point.
All right. Then metal plating, metal plating, like big metal chest metal plating, big metal plating, right? Nipples, a little bit weird, metal nipples, a little weird, a little bit Joel Schumacher there. Like, is that really necessary? Okay. Shoulder pads, big shoulder pads, just like plate metal barbed wire shoulder pads. Okay. And it's dark around the face, dark around this area, right? And you see what looks like a large helmet, right? And the goalie was like, now I present to you your challengers. It's two heads.
What?
It's Justin and Brian. Clone Justin, clone Brian, sewn onto one giant warrior.
Okay. I say Justin, I jump up so that I'm
wait,
looking.
Wait. Are you clone Brian? Are you two-headed clone Brian, Justin, Joe Bry?
No, it's this is me, Brian, actual Brian. Jumping up to mind-controlled, also actual Justin, I jump up to him, and I look at him. I grab him by the robot lapels he has, and I shake him a little bit, and I look him in the eye, and I kind of slap him on the face. And I was like, come on, man. I need you here. I need you to fight.
I think I remember, or I'm trying to blink to Brian, that there are tubes. I'm trying to twitch, because there's apparently tubes with mind-control serum.
Yeah, I reach
meanwhile,
forward.
Two-headed... Jubri, I guess Justin Bry.
Jubri. I like Jubri.
Let's not. Let's stay away. Vito. Considering some of the other predilections that we've had in terms of recurring characters.
Bry Jew? Is Bry Jew working for you?
Jubri.
Jubri's fine.
Jubri? What is Jubri doing?
I don't know.
Are we controlling Jubri?
Doi, evil clone versions of yourself that have been welded onto one body.
Wait, I yank out the mind control fluid. I just grab it. I just yank it right out.
It splashes in your mouth. It tastes really weird.
Yeah. I resist any.
And you feel like you'll do anything at that moment.
I resist any of that. I kind of shake Justin and I say, look, I think we could control Jubri over here. And I show by attempting to raise my right arm. But I don't know if I can yet. So. Does it work?
Did you raise your right arm?
Well, I did. I raised my right arm.
Congratulations.
You raised your right arm. The 3 months of therapy of work. Maybe you can squeeze a ball next. Are you proud of yourself?
All right, wait. Let me just get clarification. So we as players can control Jubri, but our characters cannot. They do not know that they can control Jubri.
Exactly. Jubri is his own two-headed entity that thinks like you guys.
Okay. Well, then I'm going to say Jubri, if I guess we can only control Jubri if we both work together.
I think Jubri wants to help us.
Yeah, Jubri.
No, Jubri wants to destroy, kill.
Well, this puts us in a very hard position.
It's hard to
play the game if we're supposed to also be our villain. Jubri combined both Brian and Justin's insecurities and falls down. And
let's have
crying.
Another cocktail party with Hitler. Okay.
All right. So Jubri comes barreling towards us, and I imagine that at this point I'm just trying to see if Justin is out of his fog yet.
Yeah, am I out of my fog yet?
You're getting out of your fog. Now I'm gonna say that. You hear the gold member cackling, ha ha, they only know his weakness. Those two like to argue over everything.
That's a good point, actually. Jubri, I shout at Jubri, and I said, oh, so you found the weasel, did you? He was talking bad about how doughy you were. Brian, he said that no amount of working out will ever get you back to how you looked in your 30s.
Clearing from my fog, I yell at Jubri, yeah, And remember that thing you said? Everybody took it personal, and now they hate you. They've harbored this grudge for years.
Jubri pauses. Jubri 1 and Jubri 2 sort of stare at each other. There is a flicker in Jubri Bry's face of just this kind of looking down, and he sees the six pack and he's thinking like, this is great. While Jubri Justin,
seeing his glance, I shout, those are fake and you know it. In your heart, you know you're doughy and schlubby under there.
Jubri Justin sort of is stopping and looking off into this loft in the distance, a little bit morose, distant, won't tell you what's going on, but you know there's something going on there.
He's hiding his contempt right next to you. He secretly hates and resents every fiber of your being.
And then I shout out, attempting to sow discord, a fight between them. I say, you see that that garage door over there behind me? Inside are bikes. So many bikes. This, you can ride all the bikes you want.
Jubri Bry looks towards the bikes and turns towards Jubri Justin and says, I told you so! I told you so!
And then I shout out, this is a good idea from the ghost of Bryce. I shout, you can ride the bikes to the space elevator! We saw it on our way in! It's majestic!
And then I yell, I told you he's still harboring it. He remembers everything. And it's all your fault.
Okay, at this point, I hop on robot mech because Justin's a good, like, 15, 20 feet tall in this getup. Okay, so I hop up on his shoulders, and I grab with the left hand. With the right hand, I hold up my chainsaw, and I was like, now, while they're distracted, we strike.
And then I say, Brian, there's only one way we can defeat them, while they're distracted. I know this is going to sound weird, but I need you to grab around my thigh because we're going to do a somersault into a butt chainsaw right through the both of them.
That is so outrageous. It just might work. I immediately drop down to his thigh. I rev the chainsaw.
Jubri Justin goes, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Jubri Brian goes, you're just copying the butt gun. That's just the same thing.
I said, point of fact, this Justin had an original thought because he wasn't even there for the butt gun. And then I'm like, now strike.
Yeah, and so then I with my enhancements, I do a full a Boston Dynamics robot somersault.
Jubri Brian turns with his one hand, looks up at the Golden Emperor like, is this even allowed?
I very quickly, do the backflip jump, I leap out of Justin's butt. And just like I'm doing the what was the Cannonball Express or what was the thing where Colossus would throw Logan at people? That's I do that.
Yeah, and so Brian goes flying out as the somersault hits the absolute peak and comes in at tremendous velocity with his chainsaw hand right into the heart of Jubri.
Chainsaw digs into chest, digs into leather, digs into the metal, starts spewing, and all of a sudden there's blood. It's everywhere. It's horrific. And then you feel the chainsaw just cut right into a heart.
Ooh! I offer a warrior's cry of triumph, and then I try to lift the chainsaw to split his chest asunder.
So you split up on the chest, right? Mm-hmm. Now Jubri Justin's going like that, and Jubri Bry is like, bro, dude, why? Why?
I punch Jubri Brian right in the face and say, that's for that episode with Corey and Martin.
I swallow down my tinge of regret hearing him live out that fantasy. instead, I just cut off Jubri Justin's head.
Goes rolling across the floor and into the crowd. Turns out there are people in orchestra seats.
What is the crowd's reaction?
They start throwing it around the arena.
And so I turn and throw my arms up in triumph as I stand on Justin's shoulder.
And I just do a two animation move like the Final Fantasy winter music is playing.
And then I say, you want to get out of here, Justin?
And I say, Brian, I was hoping you'd say that because I have no idea what's happening. but we need to leave. Okay, this place is weird.
Assuming the door is still open where Jubri emerged from, I gesture towards it and I say, as fast as you can, Justin, because I assume it's faster for me to just ride on Justin's shoulder.
Also, can I ask the DM what? Can I get a little background on what I remember between the last time that the real me was seen and where I am now?
You remember going into the jungle and then maybe feeling a dart and then sort of something, maybe some sort of experiment, some medical stuff going on. But that's kind of, you know, people asking to fill out a lot of forms, asking what your HMO was.
Okay, so I don't know much about the Golden Emperor or where I am or anything like that.
No, you're dumb.
Okay, then I don't know where we are, Bri, but it's scary. Let's leave.
Let's good. And I go, yeah, as if you're my steed. But then I whisper under my breath, but we are equal partners. and then I point.
So you charge to the backstage. All right. Area.
Aside from the troubling animal farm esque analogies here, I decide to continue as your beast of burden.
You charge to the back area there, and there's like a menagerie of animals. Like there is a rhino with a chainsaw horn, right? You know, they call it a brino. And there's a guy with the standing next to the cage, watching you guys make your escape. He's like, oh, sorry, Brino. You're not going to get your match. You know, there's an elephant with an electrified trunk, which is really kind of cool. A bunch of chimpanzees, not geared chimpanzees, but there are a bunch of chimpanzees with Wolverine claws, but like four instead of three, so we're not sued. And they're really cut up, too. They've actually cut themselves up quite a bit. It's not the best idea. It sounded like a cool idea, but it really, really wasn't.
They didn't so much have the healing factor, so they just start bleeding all the time.
Yeah, they're like, kind of like, and like the, and then you see a doorway down a corridor. You go run through there, then you burst out into...
Wait a minute. Hold on, wait a minute. Before we do that, I stop, and I tell Brian, I don't know who these sons of bees that did this to me were, but I think it's time that they all pay. What do you say we let loose all these animals into that crowd?
Yes, I scan for a big red button that presumably will open up all the gates at once.
Some guy eating a big hoagie sandwich stands next to a button, says, "No, not this button. You're not allowed to press this button."
I say, "Pound sand, dweeb," and I punch him right in the face. Brian, hit the button.
I hit the button, and then after the doors open, I cut the cord so it can't be they can't be closed again.
Cool. And you punch him in the balls too, just so he
can't get yes, that too.
What about a sandwich? Are you going to take a sandwich too?
What kind of sandwich is it? Does it have mayonnaise on it?
That was my same question.
No mayonnaise. Some Dijon, but no mayonnaise. It's a big capicola. Big, warm capicola.
Yellow mustard or bust. I'll leave it on the ground. <All
right. laughs> Okay. So you go right out. You run through a corridor. You burst into the arena lobby, and what do you see? Merchandising stalls going on for half a mile.
Oh my God.
What's there? You see the
Jubri.
There's like a bunch of Jubri, but some guy's already packing this stuff away and putting, like, you know, send to El Salvador.
it's you know, the team. They're screen printing instead of a Super Bowl champ. It says, you know, Western Division champ, Jubri.
Yeah, and there's a stall with Brian Chainsaw Warrior, and it's you.
Awesome.
The yellow shirts. Yeah.
I grab some shirts with my face.
Yeah, they're just like in girls' small size, but you know.
No, that's great. That's great. I put one on awkwardly, and yeah. and so like my guts kind of hanging out.
All right. So you're looking for the Justin stall. there's you're looking for that, and finally there's the mind control Justin t-shirts.
does it say mind control Justin?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Mike Little Justin. Yeah.
I just imagine it's like the most unflattering blank, like just.
Oh yeah. Like, it's just sort of like you're half drooling. You're like.
Just like drooling.
Okay. I gesture to the front gate, figuring that we gotta make tracks and get out of here fast.
So you head towards the door. Security's like, we're gonna get out of your way. we're not even paid enough for this, right? But you hear footsteps behind you.
Uh huh.
Wait.
I glance over my shoulder and assess the situation.
Short guy, maybe about 5'4", 5'5", whatever. Okay, wearing a suit.
Yeah.
Holding a contract.
I say, stop. Let me see that. I grab the paper and I scan real quick. First of all, is it signed?
No, not signed. He's holding up a pen.
Oh, you want to sign? I look over the terms and conditions. Mainly concerned about exclusivity and whether or not existing projects.
Before, all right, hey, team meeting, very quick team meeting here. These people enslaved us and forced us to fight. I don't really think that they. I know that you have already signed deals for television projects, and that seems very dangerous and low reward. But like. Let me just say, this might be beyond the pale. I think we need to GTFO.
Whoa! I'm not with the Golden Emperor, okay?
Okay, where, who are you?
I'm an agent.
Okay, agent? What do you represent?
I represent champions, winners, the best. That's who I represent.
All right. Do you have any kind of deals that involve us not participating or... fighting for our lives anymore?
Nah, everything's got its risk. We can do the post-apocalyptic wrestling league. You know, that's pretty good. You know, the death matches are kind of rare there. If you want to do the wasteland circuit, we could do that. That sounds pretty cool. You know, I think we get a couple matches, 4 or 5 in there, then we set you up for a pay-per-view and you're good for life.
Justin, this does sound very generous. This sounds like a good deal.
Since... we previously found out that we are not in an alternate dimension, that we are indeed just still in the regular dimension, and we have gone on this wild...
Like, yeah, this is East Texas, don't you know?
Yeah. We have really not gone far since we left. How fast can you get us to Los Angeles and San Francisco?
How fast can you kill a gorilla... with, ready for this?
Yeah.
A gorilla with an adorable kitten controlling it.
Ooh, that's pretty good. Quick question. In the contract, do they have replacement ding-dongs? This hose situation's not really working
for me. I know a guy that will set you up with one you won't...
Justin, come on.
He unzips his trousers, drops it down, and you're like, that looks perfectly normal. You're like, exactly.
All right. It's a fast side quest, Justin, right? I mean, it's like...
he says, like, you'd never guess, but... And then he pairs it to his iPhone by squeezing the stuff.
<Ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-boom. laughs> And then he's like, check this out. He reaches into his jacket. He pulls out a slip of paper. And it's a totally original idea, not something I just stole from Bryce. He says, how about this? Pan-American, post-apocalyptic, after the nuclear meltdown, a cop-pocalypse, we said that again, Rumble Royale, not the Royal Rumble, Rumble Royale.
With cheese.
Cheese, being held in Oakland, California.
Justin, We go on the road. We do this gig. We get to Oakland. I get a replacement.
I know that this journey has taken a lot of lefts and rights, but the entire goal here is to get to Los Angeles to make sure that our co-host Andrew Main is still alive.
With the live pre-show in Los Angeles, and then he reaches into his jack and he pulls out a brochure, and what is this? This is the tour bus. It's not just any tour bus. It's a tour bus with gun turrets, razor wire, all sorts of things you can imagine. What's that on the back? He's like, check this out. A bike rack.
Justin. All we got to do is fight just a little bit on the road. This really seems like win-win-win. Mainly for me, because I get a ding-dong.
Brian, check the contract to make sure that side projects are still available.
Okay, all right. I look at the contract, assuming everything checks out, I scribble my name with my good life.
Wait, hold on. Ask him if everything checks out. Does everything check out?
Everything checks out. A-okay.
Oh, good, good. Then I press my thumb, putting my thumbprint on there, and I cut my stuff and bleed a little bit on there and get some DNA in there just to make sure.
Cool. Justin?
I...
Man, you just woke up from a mind control slumber.
And I'm going to tell you, you're a little bit hungry, and there's a snack bar over there. And you don't have any money. And he's like, by the way, there's $1 million signing bonus.
I mean, it just seems like there's nothing.
All right. I sign the contract.
Wonderful. He's a great gentleman. Pulls out a briefcase. Here's your $1 million signing bonus.
Oh, awesome. I look for a compartment to put the money in RoboMech Justin.
Fantastic. You pull those bills out. They're beautiful. They're green. And you're like, great. We now own 1 million Bryce bucks.
Oh, okay. We work.
Gentlemen, first fight, Bryce Vegas.
Oh, all right.
At least we're heading west.
All right. It's getting us somewhere on the
Bryce
way.
Bryce Vegas, Oklahoma.
Oh, God damn it. I mean, northwest, maybe, north. Depending on where we are.
I turn to the camera and say, it's a living, as it fades into a tiny black circle.
And your Marty Johnson McPhee, your agent, says, man, you guys are stars already. You're already playing to the documentary crew, which is shooting this for the reality TV show that we're making about this, too.
All right. So I guess we head out to Vegas.
Then I immediately look at the camera crew and say, do we want to run that back? Do it again? Did you guys get all the coverage?
Back
you
to one. You want safety?
You want to go back to one?
Next time on Journey Quest,
we see whether or not they need to go back to one. Yes.
Picks.
Yeah, I got a pick. I just read a book and I loved it. I loved it a lot. I didn't expect to be so enamored with the world, but C. Robert Cargill's Sea of Rust is fantastic. Oh, cool. It's great. It takes place, you know, after robots, killed all the humans. Like, that definitely happened. But now they've got bigger problems because some of the robots are giant mainframes that figure out, you know, instead of all these millions and millions of independent humanoid, independently thinking robots, what if they were all just me? And then they all started fighting with each other. The mainframes are fighting with each other. The little robots are caught in the crossfire, and adventures ensue. It's great. It's I really enjoyed it. It was an easy 10-hour read on Audible, and I liked it very, very much. It's well performed as well.
Excellent, Justin.
I got an Audible book as well. Donna Brazile, who ran the DNC during the embattled campaign of Hillary Clinton in 2016, wrote a book. It is at its best in the first half when it is focused on the interaction between her campaign or her leadership of the DNC and the Hillary Clinton campaign. You are reminded as you continue to go further that Donna Brazile is a lifelong political activist, and a fair amount of it is, I think, her making sure that her draft of history kind of gets written. Well, on both sides of the aisle, I guess. But it is specifically through the first half, what you want in for political junkies like me, raw first person perspective on the boiler room moments of a high stakes campaign, which I love. So and she performs the audiobook, which is great because she is from New Orleans and has a very distinctive voice, which pretty good. So I liked it.
Excellent. So I've been working on a software project, which means when I do that, I spend a lot of time sitting in front of my computer and I'm able to sort of be passively entertained by something. And my pick last week was, I think, Adventures in Space and Time, which was about, you know, Verity Lambert and the creation of the show Doctor Who. And I said, you know what? I've never watched the really, really old episodes like the John Hartnell ones. And I had the BritBox subscription. I said, you know what? Why don't I go start there? So I started watching from episode one of Doctor Who forward, and I'm like 30 episodes in or something because it's just sort of playing in the background. But again, I'm not like – it's not like if I were just watching them without doing something else, it might be a little bit harder to watch. But it's – you know, I really like the fact that it's – you know, this is 1963. This is pre-Star Trek, pre-anything. This is like our first kind of like – one of the first earliest episodic sci-fi shows exploring space, et cetera, and working with very limited resources to do that and pretty, you know, pretty impressed for what they're able to do and how they try to make these stories work, you know, visiting these different civilizations, dealing with different problems and stuff. And I kind of, you know, I was, you know, I've been enjoying it.
Very cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So anyhow, gentlemen, it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.